The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Friday, the 17th of April, 2020. On the podcast today, Paul Kent, esports director at Gfinity, discusses what it means to be selected by Willow TV to deliver the Cricket Challenge in partnership with Betway. Also on the podcast, Anna Basu, CEO of Cromec Group, talks about their intention to commence production of Metron-based ventilators in response to COVID-19. Plus, Nigel Theobald, CEO of N4 Pharma, discusses their project to demonstrate the ability of Nuvec to be used as a delivery system by potential partners developing COVID-19 vaccines. And Paul Hill, full-time investor and equity analyst, gives his view on the market and what stocks he's been looking at, including Barrett Developments, Taylor Wimpey. Also, we mentioned, I think, EasyJet and Greggs and a couple of others, AutoTrader as well. Plus, as always, I have two lists for you. The top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours and the top five most liked RNSs. By the way, you can see both these lists, top 10 versions of both these lists, at voxmarkets.co.uk, where you can also see our COVID-19 index. Check that out. These are companies that are helping in the fight against the coronavirus at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Are you tired of missing news about stock market companies you follow? The Vox Markets app helps investors stay ahead by making sure you never miss an important update. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Paul Kent, esports director at Gfinity. G-F-I-N is the ticker there. Paul, thanks for joining me.
Hey, you're welcome. Thank you. Thank you very much for having me on the show. Yeah, it's a pleasure speaking to you.
Yeah, well, listen, you've released an interesting sort of RNS out today about being selected to deliver the e-cricket challenge, and we'll get into that in a bit because, of course, there's some massive opportunities opening up for certain sectors of industry, especially some e-sports and gaming and all that, but we'll get into that in a bit. Before we do, Paul, for people maybe not familiar with Gfinity, can you explain what the business is all about, please?
Certainly. So Gfinity is one of the world's leading esports companies. And as for what esports is, that is effectively digital gaming. So if you think of people who play games like Call of Duty or FIFA, which I'm sure everybody's heard of, people actually not just play that for fun, but they play that competitively. And what we do is we take those competitions and we bring them into entertainment products, broadcast products, content-driven products, and also we give people a place to play.
Yeah, absolutely. So the RNS here, virtual gaming. So how is this virtual gaming helping to plug the gap now left by lack of live sport that's happening due to the coronavirus?
Well, the great thing about digital gaming is the fact that it's all done remotely. It's all online, so you don't have to be in one place. So as we know, unfortunately, with the current environment that we're living in, sports have been put in hiatus because people can't gather in one location. The beauty with digital gaming is people can do it remotely from all over the world, and so because of that, we are able to fill this void and really give this demand, meet this demand for live content. So when we talk about gaming, it's not something new. We shouldn't forget that more people watched YouTube gaming last year in the US than watched Netflix. We shouldn't forget that the kids of today, their default position is to watch Twitch, which is a gaming streaming platform, or watch YouTube rather than going watch traditional media partners. Yeah. And so what we've been doing while sports have been shut down is the more traditional broadcasters are embracing competitive gaming and esports to fill that void. And so recently, for example, we've been working with Formula One, who are one of our partners, and we've been doing a virtual Grand Prix. So effectively, as a real for Formula One fans, it's the same as a real thing, but it's moved digitally and it's moved into a game. And we've had 20 drivers taking part as if it would be a normal F1 race, including real life F1 drivers, and that's going out to 50 linear broadcasts around the world with 500,000 concurrent viewers at any one time, up from when we did it 2 weeks ago or 4 weeks ago now. It started off at 400,000. So that trajectory is on the right way. The curve is going up, and it's a positive curve rather than the flattening the curve.
Yeah, do you know what? You were just explaining it, describing my kids then. I've got kids of 10 and 7. And listen, they love Fortnite. And if they're not playing Fortnite. I drag them off the screen and playing Fortnite, and all of a sudden I turn my back and they're watching people play Fortnite on YouTube. And some of the viewers and subscribers these guys got, I mean, BBC One would be proud to have that kind of viewership. It's amazing the amount of viewers these people get, isn't it? Unbelievable.
Yeah, I think that it's a significant shift in the youth of today, where we grew up a long time ago, with maybe, well, at least for my generation, there was four or five channels on TV, and that's what you were used to. The kids today, they're disconnected from traditional broadcast partners, and for them, they feel part of a movement in gaming. Yeah. They feel, though, that watching their famous Fortnite stars or their FIFA stars or their Call of Duty stars, which are all just gamers, they feel, to them, that's their idols. That's their... Raheem Sterling's, that's their Harry Kane's, that's their David Beckham's. Regardless of your generation, we all had sporting heroes. To them, it's gaming heroes, and they feel part of that movement. That's one of the greatest things about gaming. Where in the world of traditional sports and broadcasts, people are really disconnected. You're a big fan of it, but it's one step removed. Where in the gaming world, you feel like they're part of this massive movement, and that's a really powerful thing.
Yeah. So how do you sort of connect live people in different continents take part in sort of one live virtual gaming show then?
Well, yeah, it's worth saying that although virtual gaming here is helped to fill the void left by traditional sports, it doesn't necessarily mean it's easier. It is a lot more challenging in many ways to do esports as a live broadcast. If you think of football, all that happens is a broadcast property is two teams turn up at a park, they start kicking a ball about, and cameras have to be pointed in that direction. It's very, very easy to do, especially nowadays. Where in the world of gaming, there's not that real world physical activity, so you're dependent on multiple computers, game servers, internet connections. There's 100, if not thousands, of components in that workflow that could go wrong at any point. So right now, particularly as people are isolating at home and not allowed to go out in the world, one of the technical challenges we're having, if you take the cricket that we announced today, we're bringing players from the West Indies to Australia, to England, all together in the cloud, shall we say, to play each other while we're still bringing in their camera feeds, their audio feeds. We're making sure that not only do their camera and their game feeds and their video feeds route through our production facilities, our remote production facilities, and then routes back out so they can speak to each other. So there's a lot of moving parts. It's technically challenging, but the great thing for esports is this environment is where we've been working for the last 4 or 5 years. So where traditional broadcasters are very set in their means, we've been embracing new software-driven technologies for a long time. And what you're now seeing, particularly as we're in this stay-at-home, shall we say, environment, we're now seeing even big broadcasters around the world embracing the technologies which esports have been pioneering for quite a few years.
Yeah, and I suppose over the last, 6 weeks now, since COVID-19 has invaded our lives, you know, it's impacted some companies negatively, some positively, it's given opportunities. So what activity has, you know, Gfinity been undertaking over the last couple of weeks, and what's been the results then?
So we've been incredibly busy. We are a long-term partner of Formula One. So we deliver the Formula One esports series for them around the world, which involves all 10 F1 teams taking part. As it stands just now, obviously those would normally be physical events in the studios, but because that cannot happen, what we've been doing with F1, given the fact that they also can't do their real life races, we've come up with what we call a virtual Grand Prix. So every Sunday night we're actually hosting a live race that goes out on 50, if not more than 50 linear broadcast partners, as well as various social media platforms from Facebooks to your YouTubes to your Twitches around the world. And so what we're actually doing is filling the gap for them. We're bringing some of their up and coming real life F1 drivers, we're bringing celebrities in, we're bringing sports stars from different sports, so for example Chris Hoy's joining, Ben Stokes. We're having this really amazing fantasy grid, shall we say, with some of the best F1 talent, some of the best sporting talent from golf with Ian Poulter or Ben Stokes from cricket to Chris Hoy, as I mentioned, to even music stars like Liam Payne from One Direction, and they're taking part on a broadcast where people are tuning in and there are millions around the world to watch as we basically provide the Formula One Grand Prix. In addition to that, we're working with cricket. So cricket are in the same boat. What really is happening, I guess, is the best way to summarise this is a lot of these various sporting competitions, be it football, be it cricket, be it Formula One, be it golf. They've got sporting stars all around the world just sitting at home looking for some way to compete. And what we can do is we can actually bring them from all their various locations together and have them compete in virtual games, be it golf games, racing games, cricket games, while also bringing in their camera feeds and their audio feeds and actually give them that competitive platform, but an entertaining competitive platform. We can put that into a proper broadcast show and put it out and distribute it around the world. And people are really, really enjoying it. And even today, we've announced that we're also working, as we have been for the last 2 years, English Premier League. It's again, we're doing an activation with them, which will bring some of the biggest stars in English Premier League. We'll play against each other using the game FIFA. And again, we'll put it into a broadcast show, and people around the world will enjoy seeing their favourite sports stars play in the virtual world.
Yeah. I've just watched the video early on. It's very, very exciting. And so what have you seen, in terms of varying approaches taken by sort of traditional sports organisations and their athletes, when it comes to getting involved then in these sports?
So we've spoken to... We have existing relationships with various sports rights holders, but we've also spoken to even, I would say, upwards of 10 various other sports rights holders. And it's safe to say that their approach... varies, shall we say. Mm-hmm. Some are quite keen to embrace it, and that really actually comes down to what they've been doing in the previous few years. So if you take Formula One, for example, we've been working with them for 3 years, so they're really across the esports space and really see it as a part of their future. So when this came along, they were prepared to instantly move fast. We actually put the first virtual Grand Prix on air with 3 days' notice because we had various workflows and processes in place that we could move fast. And then where you take some other sports rights holders who are perhaps been looking at esports from a distance and know at some point they want to do it, and now is the perfect opportunity, but because they've not dipped a toe in the water so far, shall we say, they're a bit nervous, and we're working through with them slowly, because what they don't want to do is they don't want to have a knee-jerk reaction. They don't want just to do something for the sake of doing something. So we're working slowly with them. But then equally, someone like cricket, who have not done something in esports really so far, they've really embraced it. So although they're nervous about their first offering, they've moved quite quickly. So it's safe to say, as in like all walks of life, some are risk takers, some are more pragmatic. Mm-hmm. What I would say is there's a consistent view across every sports rights holders and many brands as well, that they all want to be involved in esports, and they see this as a great opportunity to do it. And actually, esports is here to stay for them because it's a way to embrace their audience all time. So I think no one would ever, on a risk disaster plan, would ever have thought what would happen if we can't play any football matches or we can't have any races. All of a sudden now they know that if that ever happens, as it's happening just now, well, actually we can still have a digital offering.
Yeah. And at the moment, companies are starting to feel the pressure financially. They're struggling. Well, some are more than others, of course. So can they afford to dive into virtual gaming? Or maybe you should rephrase that. Can they afford not to dive into virtual gaming? They've got to do it, haven't they?
I don't think they can afford not to, because the other issue they've got is if you set the current environmental factors to one side, the average age of a fan of any sports is getting old. The youth of today are not rushing out to buy season ticket holders. So that demographic that they're appealing to is starting to get a lot older than perhaps they would like. So they need to embrace that younger audience, and that might no longer be the way that they've traditionally done it, of expecting people to watch Match of the Day on a Saturday night. That may have gone. So I think they can't afford to ignore esports. I think they do have to embrace it. And I think in regards from a financial point of view, there's no denying that right now esports compared to, again, if you use F1, putting on an F1 race is a very, very expensive thing to do.
Yeah.
Putting on a virtual race will never come close to the same cost. However, the reach could actually be just as big, if not bigger, in many years to come.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and probably environmentally better as well. As far as, long-term impact of esports gaming, what's your thoughts there?
Well, I think one of the greatest things, maybe that's the wrong turn of phrase, but one of the greatest things about esports is it can be done from home. You don't have to be dependent on having to go to one location. And in right now, in the environments we're currently living in, unfortunately, around the world, that means that many, many more people who perhaps were not into esports or competitive gaming are embracing it. And so it's becoming more and more mainstream. Esports is a massive sector, but it's still a massive niche, but it's still a niche. And right now, as we're seeing people around the home looking for entertainment, as they're stuck indoors, they're embracing gaming. And with that, we're now starting to see mainstream entertainment platforms and broadcast platforms and media and content writers also embracing esports, because right now it's the only thing they really can do for live action. And they're realising that actually it is actually just as enjoyable in many ways as the real things, particularly in the world of motorsports, where the jump between a real car and a virtual car, they're both really just advanced computers nowadays, particularly high-end sports. So the bridge isn't that crazy. So right now I think what's happening is people, due to it being a captive audience, are really starting to understand and embrace competitive entertainment and gaming in esports in a way that perhaps was not done up until now.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, Paul, well, every day in the podcast I highlight the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets platform. So just in summary there, in bullet point form, if you could, for people listening right now liking the sound of the progress you're making but are not yet following the story, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
So trends are changing. The youth of today are embracing gaming more than traditional other forms of entertainment. That obviously then means bullet point number two is a massive growing industry. It's getting bigger by the day. And then bullet point number three is, even though it is a massive gaming industry, it owns the 16 to 30 year old market. It's massively undervalued still.
Marvellous stuff. Paul, good to chat to you. Hopefully we'll catch up in the not too distant future. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Arnab Basu, CEO of Kromek Group. That's KMK ticker. Arnab, thanks for joining me.
It's a pleasure.
Now, we've not had you on the podcast before, and you've released an RNS which suggests you've pivoted temporarily the business a little bit. But before we get into that news, Arnab, can you just describe Kromek, the business, please? What's it all about?
So Kromek is a radiation detection technology company serving three global markets, medical imaging, security screening, and nuclear detection. Our products are based on a class of radiation detectors called cadmium zinc telluride, mm-hmm. which is a semiconductor material that we specialize in. We are only one of three companies in the world who is able to produce this material at the right quality and quantity. So we are one of the three commercial suppliers. Our products are used every day in hospitals, in airports, by security personnel, military personnel, but also by people running nuclear power plants, and of course in explosive detection in airports as well. So it's we are a UK and US business, so we operate out of four sites in Sedgefield is our in County Durham is our headquarters where I am based in and our senior management. Our second manufacturing facility is in Pittsburgh in United States, and we too have two engineering offices, one in California in Riverside and one in Huddersfield, where we develop particular specialist parts of our technology. So we are a manufacturing business. We have a very good blue chip customer list, and over the last 3 years or so, we have secured over £130 million worth of orders. So we are on the path of commercialization, and we have got very, very good traction from the market.
Yeah, absolutely. And so you say nuclear, medical, and security. So how does it break down percentage-wise, roughly? Are they equal, or is it one bigger than the other?
No, we actually don't report exact percentages, but medical and nuclear are the two of our larger markets.
Yeah.
And security screening, which is aviation security, is, although we have a very strong presence in there, in both in baggage screening and very in very particular space of liquid explosive detection, that is relatively a smaller market. And we do have an emerging sector within the business, which is in detection of biopathogens, which we started off through a work with DARPA in the United States, which is part of the United States Department of Defense. And there's some very exciting development going on.
Yeah, yeah. Well, talk about the recent news. So you announced you're going to commence production of Metron-based ventilators for the COVID-19 issue here. So take us through this, if you could, Arnab.
This is in direct response to the crisis we are all living through. As many companies around the world, we expect to see a bit of a pause in our traditional market over the next 3 to 4 months and the uncertainty that is built into it. So we decided to play to our strengths and see how we could both contribute to the current crisis to help fight the COVID-19 crisis, but also from a business point of view, how can we quickly react to this situation and see how what we could do as a business. Two of our key strengths, we sell in, as I say, over 40 countries, so we have got very strong relationship, partnerships and networks around the world. And secondly, we are a manufacturer of pretty complex devices, and we know how to scale up manufacturing. Mm-hmm. So we looked at out for opportunities and we came across Metron, who were looking for partners to upscale their manufacturing capability and sales and marketing capability of their ventilators to meet a real big global demand. We worked with Department of International Trade and the British Embassy in Tokyo. Very quickly got to build up a very strong relationship and a deal with Metron, and now we are in a position to start commence of manufacturing of up to 2,000 ventilators within the next 12 weeks.
Wow, that's amazing how you just, you know, pivot, yeah, and use your ability and your resourcefulness there to that. So you're going to scale up, and as far as, you know, I mean, I know in Europe, parts of Europe, and of course in the Far East there, the figures are plateauing out. So how long do you think this demand will be around for, do you think?
Look, I mean, as you are probably aware, some countries are out, you know, getting out of the crisis. Some countries are right in the middle of the crisis, and some countries are yet to get to the peak of the crisis. So it is a wave, in a way, how it is being looked at around the world. The demand curve is very, very strong with immediate needs. But also the second point is building up resilience within nations, I think. The countries around the world have realized that when something like this happens, demand for certain things goes up extremely rapidly. The traditional supply sources are not able to cope with it. And so huge effort has to be made to actually put infrastructure in place. As we have seen around the world, non-traditional ventilator manufacturers are getting involved in ventilator manufacturing, starting from design from complete scratch. Now, countries are taking a very different view, as we are starting to see, where they want to build up resilience within countries, particularly countries where they feel that they may have not had access to ventilators when they really need, and still not getting access to ventilators where they need. So we are seeing a huge demand and expecting the demand to continue over the next 3, 6, 12 months as the world gets through this crisis, comes out on the other side and starts to build resilience within nations.
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose then it's just see where you are after the 12-week period, just see if you need to continue producing, or what's the score there?
We are receiving very large inquiries at the moment, more than the stated capacity that we have put out. Mm-hmm. So we will see how that goes and what our strategy, how our strategy evolves. As and when that happens, we will come back and, of course, you know, update the market and talk about it. And hopefully within the next 8 to 12 weeks, we will have a much clearer path to understanding whether this becomes a more mid-term strategy for us or whether this will stay a short-term strategy.
Yeah, and it's maybe a bit of a silly question, but is this profitable for you?
Indeed. Yeah. I think we have to always think about that at the end of that machine, there is somebody who is extremely ill this is a great cause to be contributing to. And we feel pretty grateful and humbled that we are able to contribute in a meaningful way. But yes, it is also good news for the business because it will retain and preserve jobs and hopefully add to shareholder value.
Yeah, and I suppose, of course, when demand for this side of the business, disperses or drops off, then that means that the other parts of your business are ready to ramp up again, I suppose.
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay. Well, on the podcast, I'll highlight the top five most followed companies on the platform every day. So to get on that list, please give us three reasons why someone should hit that follow button and add you to their watch list, please.
We are diversified in terms of our sectors. We are very strong in medical, nuclear, and security. So in terms with a common technology base, so that's one reason. So we are sectorially protected. We have a strong order book that we built up over the last 3 years, which with a very good forward-looking visibility. And thirdly, and I think this is in the current circumstances, I think it is very important that the resilience within the business that we have built up in terms of our ability to react to opportunities and react quick and fast shows us both in terms of the innovative nature of the business, but also the commercial depth within the business.
Excellent stuff. Arnab, good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll catch up in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Nigel Theobald, Chief Executive Officer of N4 Pharma. N4P is the ticker there. Nigel, thanks for joining me.
Good morning, Justin. Good to have me.
Yeah, well, we haven't spoken for a while. Last time we were on, we were speaking about a different sort of product. But now you're helping join the fight, I suppose, against this virus that's affecting every single one in the world. I think it's like half the population is under restriction at the moment. So it literally is, affecting everyone pretty much. And so you've released an RNS about the project, the COVID-19 project update and operational update there. And we'll dig into that. Before we do, Nigel, just a quick summary for people not familiar with N4 Pharma. What's it all about, please?
Okay, so at N4, we're a specialty pharmaceutical company, and we have a unique delivery system for working with nucleic acids, such as DNA and messenger RNA. And what it is, it's a tiny silica nanoparticle, and it's they call it a mesoporosphere, so it's a tiny little hollow sphere with gaps, and it has spikes around the side of it, and those spikes allow us to trap DNA and RNA within the spikes so that we can get it into the cell and thereby release the DNA and the RNA once the delivery system has got it into the cell. So yeah, that's what we have in a nutshell. So we are the delivery system, not the actual we don't own the DNA or the RNA vaccines and treatments ourselves, but we own the way that you get them into the cell.
Yeah. And so where are you with this at the moment? Are you starting to do this, or are you going to start to do this?
Well, so what we've been working on this now for a good 18 months or so, nearly 2 years, generating the data so that we can reach out to partners who want to license delivery systems for developing vaccines and treatments. So what we've been doing is a lot of proof of concept work to show exactly how Nuvec behaves. So we've shown that it works. We've shown that it always loads DNA, RNA onto it. It always works when we do in vitro tests. And we've done a couple of very large studies where we've looked at showing how it works with delivering antibodies using a research plasmid called OVA. So a DNA of OVA, which is just something people use to demonstrate how systems behave. Yeah. And the reason for doing that proof of concept is we need to partner with someone. So we need to partner with somebody who's got the actual RNA or the actual DNA themselves, and we want them to use our system rather than one of the existing ones that they use. So, for example, people developing DNA products tend to use electroporation, which is a machine that you use to open up cells to get them in. People using RNA tend to use lipid nanoparticles, and other people use viral vectors or proteins directly. Now, we're basically showing that showing the data to people to say, this is how our silica system behaves. It's different to these. It's got a lot more benefits. So we don't have any side effects. We don't stay in the liver. It's very easy to load and use. And the reason we're getting that information out is we then want to partner with someone to license our system to use themselves.
Yeah, and of course, I assume at the moment there's no lack of companies who you can approach, because I don't know, at last count, I think there's upward, I think 40 to 70, I read, of companies looking for a vaccine for COVID-19, and it's going to be hugely profitable for that company that breaks through first. So have you started contacting any of these companies yet?
We'll be out there talking to companies now that we're working on this COVID proof of concept project, and I think we've announced recently that we're joining a new virtual partner event. There's a big worldwide partnering event set up for people working in this space to allow us to talk to one another, because obviously we can't get together now like we would have done in the past at an actual conference because of the travel restrictions. So having the COVID proof of concept work allows us to reach out to a vast audience, and a lot bigger group of people than we would do just with our standard over plasmid work.
Yeah. So of the companies now in this space looking for a vaccine, obviously you have expertise in this sort of field or knowledge here. So I've heard that, at the earliest it'll be 12 months off, probably 18 months off to get a vaccine. First of all, is that true around about the time frame, 12 to 18 months, hopefully?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's going to take that time before anyone is even ready to start doing some proper human trials.
Yeah.
At the moment, all the human work that's being done is just basically testing safety. Mm. And people are fast rushing it because they've gone straight into humans to test safety, which is a bit of a risk. But, given the working on, people looking at risk benefit analysis on that. But once it gets into humans, you've then got to prove that it will work. Mm. And that is going to be very difficult. So it is going to take time.
Yeah.
At the moment, people can't even, you heard the government, can't even measure antibodies. So proving that you can actually immunize someone against the vaccine will be quite a challenge. But, that's one of the good things, because that means people who are working with things like DNA and RNA, because they feel that they're going to be much, much quicker to get to that point. And that's proven the case where with the two front runners in clinic at the moment, Inovio, who are using a DNA vaccine of COVID, and Moderna, who are using an mRNA vaccine of COVID, that really show that DNA and mRNA vaccines are going to be right at the forefront. And that's what our system is designed to work with.
Yeah.
We're looking at nucleic acids, and that's where we see the future of vaccine and treatment.
Yeah. And so a company, for example, now, like you mentioned there, to the people at the forefront, to the companies at the forefront of developing a vaccine, are they likely going to be open to your system compared to what they normally use?
Good question. I think, and the reality is we say we're not developing our own vaccine. So we are not expecting anybody to stop their program now and switch to our system. They're going to carry on with what they're currently doing. Mm-hmm. So, Inovio are using DNA and they're using electroporation. Moderna are using mRNA and they're using lipids, and they'll carry on doing that. But what we're doing is we're able to now show how Nuvec behaves with the COVID DNA plasmid ourselves.
Yeah.
So, if these guys either come into difficulties or decide they want to do something else and look at alternative systems, we all hope that somebody gets a vaccine straight away, but they may or may not get there. And certainly the next time another virus comes around like this, people will want to look at it. We want our system to be right up there as something that people will go to straight away for use with future vaccine development. So it allows us to showcase exactly what Nuvec does, how it behaves, and gets us on the map, and that's really what we're doing.
Yeah. And a couple of things. Say, once one company, say, discovers a vaccine, a workable vaccine, I mean, that's just a start, of course. I've heard documentaries, watched this guy say, well, listen, when you get a vaccine, you have to be able to manufacture it at scale, and that's no mean feat, because you can't replace something else, like other flu vaccines, you need those as well, so you have to create a whole new plant. And so once you get, does that wipe out the competition then, or do other companies as well keep developing vaccines for the same thing, or what?
Well, I think that's why there are so many people developing vaccines, because I can't see any one of those companies being able to supply the amount of vaccine needed to vaccinate and make the get the world immunized against COVID-19. Certainly somebody using like a DNA electroporation machine, you're not going to have anywhere near enough machines in the world to inoculate people. It's just it's going to be impossible. That might work just for maybe frontline workers, for instance. So I think there will be a number of different vaccines rather than one. And that's why there are so many people looking into this, which in itself will give its own problems for health authorities around the world as to which one to use, when, how, and why.
Yeah, I suppose because that's it. And once we have this year's out the way, like with traditional flu, the reason why we have to vaccine every year is because it mutates a bit or a different strain of it. But we have the how does that work? What is
flu mutates every year basically. So you get a different strain of influenza, and what people do typically is they try and work out what that strain is this year, and they guess, and they go and make, using proteins and bits of that, more vaccine for that particular year. And some years, most years they get it right, but some years they get it wrong, and then people still get flu. What people are trying to do, companies like Moderna, who are looking at isolating the messenger RNA that's associated with all flu, they want to develop a universal flu vaccine that will be relevant for any version of influenza, whatever mutation comes that way. So that's where a lot of companies are using DNA and RNA for, to try and come up with a universal flu vaccine that is a one size fits all. But what will be really interesting is we see what will happen, because at the moment everybody in the world of vaccine development is looking at COVID, and I bet you there's nobody starting to think now about what next year's influenza will be. So there's another story for you to cover later on.
That will be a nightmare if that's the case. Hopefully people are a bit more, a bit better at forward planning than that.
They're not doing the flu while they're focusing on COVID, but who knows.
And as far as your delivery system Nuvec is concerned, if one of these companies decide to trial yours, how does that work? Will you be paid for that or what?
The reason we're doing all this work is we want to show how it basically give the evidence to people so that then they will work with us under license, so they'll pay us a license access fee to get our technology and hopefully work along them, or they'll take it on board and develop it themselves into developing a particular area. So we can license it multi different times to people developing different products. Mm-hmm. And that's the benefit of having a delivery system. It works across a number of different areas. So not only vaccines, we've got cancer treatments, cancer vaccines, cancer therapeutics. There's a whole host of areas where nucleic acids are being used to develop products.
And what's sort of next for you? What's the next sort of bit of news, next milestone you're hoping to achieve, Nigel?
Well, mainly around the COVID work will form a lot of our milestones. So we've just announced today the detail of the program. We've got hold of the plasmid from the NIH. So this is the same company that's supplying Moderna with various things and various research companies all over the world. They've been brilliant in getting us access to that. And then we will start what we have to do is to make more of it so that we have enough for the study. Then we will do the in vitro work to show that we can actually generate the required protein in vitro. And then we'll look to repeat that work in vivo to show that we can actually generate that protein, say, in an in vivo study. And that will give us lots of, information and news as we news flow over the next few weeks.
Mm-hmm. All the stuff. Okay. Well, Nigel, as always, if someone's listening right now, like the sound of the progress you're making there, but are not yet following the story, give us three quick reasons why someone should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add you to their watch list, please.
Okay. Well, I think first off, I would say we know that Nuvec works. We've always shown that we've loaded DNA and RNA onto our system, and we've always shown that we're able to transfect cells. So we know that if we can get Nuvec into cells, it works. Mm-hmm. The second thing is we've actually shown that in antibody models using this plasmid of ova, and we've done two large studies where we've shown that we can generate antibodies. But we do know that we need to make sure that we get it well dispersed, so that when we actually inject it, it will actually get into the body in the right way. But and the third thing now is our challenge is getting noticed. So whilst we're doing all this brilliant work and showing how it works with research tools, we've never had access to a real live piece of DNA or RNA ourselves. And COVID's given us that opportunity. So we now have the DNA plasmid for the spike that represents COVID-19. And we can show exactly how Nuvec works with that DNA plasmid of COVID. So it's a real live product of interest where the whole world at the moment is currently researching. So that is going to get us noticed. And, you know, that's what we're doing at the moment, using COVID to show the proof of concept to get us right at the forefront of all the people who are developing DNA and RNA vaccines.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And by the way, are you tempted to buy any shares in Moderna or Inovio?
Well, Moderna, they have flown.
Yeah.
All of these guys have flown. So people were working on this in healthcare. Nearly everybody is working in this space has seen a very positive reaction.
Yeah.
You know, Moderna floated for 600 million a year or so ago. So there's a lot of expectation in people like Moderna who are developing RNA vaccines. And our aim is to make our system right up there alongside lipids and other systems that people are using, so that people will use our system as they develop these new products.
Yeah, well, stuff. Nigel, good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll catch up again in the not-too-distant future. All right,
lovely. Thank you very much, Justin. Pleasure to talk to you.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Paul Hill, equity analyst and full-time investor. How long again? Just remind me, Paul. When did you actually go the full-time? When did you start doing it yourself?
Well, as soon as I started earning money, so really I started work for Unilever back in September 1990. So seriously, from 1991 onwards, when I used to put, you know, money into the market, and then I've started professionally. When I then finished, I was sort of like a senior finance guy for a telecommunications company up until the end of 2003. And then really since then, I've been doing it absolutely full time and professionally. But really the whole of my life. I mean, the reason why I could actually start investing professionally was that I'd had so much success up to that point, you know, if it was over the first 12 years, that I'd built up a sort of capital base. I'd paid off my house, and I thought, right, okay, I'm, you know, what's the bigger picture? It's you know, materiality wise, it's my investments, and you know, rather than actually working. So that's why I did it.
Yeah, cool. All right, do you own any shares of Unilever?
Yeah, I did Unilever. I did usual sort of stuff. They started with the big caps and then have moved sort of like into the smaller cap area where there's greater volatility but more potential upside. So yeah, things like Unilever, and I've done I did BT, and well, what was quite interesting during the dot-com bust, when everybody was going absolutely crazy into these sort of like, you know, really small businesses that sort of had any sort of like, you know, name with dot-com at the end of it, I sort of like went into the water companies and actually did really well over the 2 year period, simply because they'd been battered so much ahead of the actual downturn that when people then rotated out of the internet stocks into sort of like normal stable businesses, the water companies did well. So I mean, we're not talking big beer, but at the time it was quite a good little, you know, sort of like return compared to everybody else was obviously their portfolios were going south. So yeah, I mean, a whole mix of different things. I still look at big caps, no doubt about it.
Yeah Well, do you know what I do in downturns like this? Because it's one, what's his name, Alarian, Mohamed Alarian, he said a very good thing about he said, you know, in times like this you can upgrade, you know.
Yes.
And that's what I've been trying to do, actually, trying to buy market leaders. And I think, because if anyone's going to survive this, it'll be the market leaders, the ones with, you know, good margins, good balance sheets, and they'll gain ground, you know.
I would agree. Exactly on that point. I mean, I suppose looking at the sort of the you know, the investor swingometer in terms of pessimism to, you know, positivity, I've actually moved more towards the sort of like the positive side over the last couple of weeks. And the reason is largely because obviously the bazooka's out of the US. And what's that effectively saying? And I mean, the same thing, I think, with the central banks and, you know, in Europe and in the UK. And what that is basically saying is that they're underwriting the market. And that's how investors are positioning themselves. They're saying, yes, there could well there'll be a, you know, downturn of another 20%, 25%, 30%, whatever it is. But then the big, you know, the central banks and the Fed will come in and support the market. And they've shown that already. So when it comes to sort of like, you know, your risk reward on the top level for the market, investors are really positioning themselves that I can stomach a 20%, 25% downturn. But the significant upside, you see, because if there is actually a V-shape, which I don't think many people think there will be, but if there was, then that would really provide upside. But if you have a sort of like a 2 to 5 year view, then you could actually make quite a lot of return. So my sort of, I'm swinging more towards the positive side, and that's why I've actually been doing quite a bit of, you know, detailed research over the past week into sort of like UK house builders, is a really, you know, it's a good area. Because, and the reason why I like UK house builders, well, one, as we all know, you know, we're not inventing land anymore, and two, if you believe that the central banks do have the back of effectively the electorate and are just going to print money, then at some point in time there's going to be a debasement of the actual fiat currency, and therefore you either want sort of like companies that have pricing power or, you know, technology and therefore can push the pricing forward, or you want sort of hard assets. And of course the house builders have that, and this comes back to your point whether you're upgrading now. There are a lot of really big UK house builders that are now trading around about net book value. And when I was digging through them over the past few days, and if anybody's interested, it's on LinkedIn and it's on PMH, you know, sorry, it's on Twitter, you can find all the details and stuff. But when I was digging through them, you know, the two which, for me, the two which stand out are Barratt Developments and Taylor Wimpey. And the reason is because they concentrate largely on the lower end of the sort of affordable housing market. The price of the shares to their book is roughly around about 1-to-1, not much difference. And they've got, and in my view, they've got sufficient liquidity to get through this sort of like desert period, and should come out the other end in a pretty good position, because, you know, the underlying market dynamics for house building is actually reasonably positive. And I've stress test the whole sector in terms of, you know, looking at number of transactions. I took it down by 10%. I took pricing down by 5% for looking it through to 2021. And as I say, I think it's quite reasonable. Now, don't get me wrong, I haven't pulled the trigger on either of those, but they are really in my sort of crosshairs of if there is another sort of down leg to the market, then that's kind of shares, you know, I think it's a widows and orphans stock that you can upgrade to. Yeah, they're £1 billion businesses, and they're in a much better shape than they were back in 2008 before they head into the financial crisis.
Yeah, well, do you know what? I mean, at the moment, like I said, I'm still largely cash. But I'm sort of breaking this down. Whenever I buy a company, I try in my head to think of it. I look at my portfolio value, and then I say, right, maximum for any one stock, maximum this is, and I say there's people for any, maximum should be 10% investment, and I even knock it down 9%, so I can split into three chunks. And my first buy, second buy, and third buy, I try and get a good average, you know, of that. And I break this crisis down into three bits. I've got the medical fallout, which we've had, and now the figures from Europe, deaths in America are still going up, but hospitalizations are going down, I assume, in New York, but in this country. So we're nearing peaks. Germany's, you know, talking about lifting lockdown. Spain, Italy are. So medical fallout now has pretty much happened here. Now, the bigger part of this, I see the second, third, is like the financial fallout. And that's going to be big, really, because, you know, if you look at the unemployment, we don't know how big it's going to be, really, but we've only just had Q1, and lockdown has only happened in the last 2 weeks, you know, so the last two weeks of the 12-week period has only just happened there. So we've had no real financial realization as to what's going to happen right now. Q2 is going to be the fallout, isn't it, where everyone sees, right, we did nothing here. A lot of companies will be stressed who haven't got a good balance sheet. So I think Q2, Q3, we'll see the financial fallout, and I think that, again, is when, so I've invested my first third into companies. I'm still looking for a couple of companies, but I'm going to wait now until we have the financial fallout, July, August area, see what happens there. And I think we'll maybe retest lows again, if not before then, run with then. But again, like you said, now is the time to start scaling 2 to 5 years. Good value to be had here, you know?
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think you're spot on in terms of the financial fallout. I mean, just look at the US banks have just started reporting. Yeah. So you had JP Morgan, you had Wells Fargo. And the size of their provisioning for non-performing loans was just frightening. Mm. I mean, if you had the same similar sort of provisions, I mean, I think JP Morgan did $8.6 billion, yeah? I think the actual share capital of somebody like Lloyd's is only about sort of like, you know, 10, 15 billion. I mean, it just is like, we're talking enormous numbers. Yeah. So you're exactly right in terms of, you know, we're going to really start seeing what that means in terms of balance sheets. I mean, my sort of base case is that we're going to start lifting, you know, the measure, the social distancing and the lockdown measures, just very tentatively over the next 2 or 3 months. And then so really for modelling purpose, up until the end of June, you could almost say, right, we've just got to sort of, you know, assume there's going to be cash burn within those businesses. And then what do they look like thereafter? I mean, I know we've talked about one in particular that I think you bought, I don't know if it's a loan, but EasyJet, for instance. Well, it came out with a trading update this morning.
Yeah.
And what it said was that it was very, very explicit. It was very useful for investors. But if it's locked down or its fleet is grounded for 9 months, it's going to lose in cash terms £3 billion, basically about £1 billion each particular quarter for three quarters. But it shows you what the actual, you know, the effect it's going to be. Now, I would say EasyJet is probably on the riskier side of putting, you know, money to work, etc. But
yeah,
I'm with you in terms of sort of like, you know, deciding upscaling and what the actual, you know, fallout's likely to be. And on the timing side, I haven't yet sort of like, you know, started redeploying, but I've got a long list of potential companies that, you know, I might well put more money into it. I mean, I've still got, you know, three, you know, companies that I've invested in, and it's more than both of them. You know, they're quite a sizable parts, you know, my portfolio. One of them actually reported, or two of them reported last week. First one was a trading update. I don't know, we've talked about it, was Alecosoft, and I don't know whether you still own it, but Frank, when I spoke to the guys, they're in a good position. They've got strong recurring revenue streams. They've got international, they've got, you know, 2/3 of the business is overseas. Software's going well. And so what's really quite interesting, they put out a tweet yesterday talking about how a lot of their customers have furloughed staff, and they don't know what to do with it, you see, because these guys, they don't want to make them redundant because they're high, you know, effectively high salaried CAD CAM designers, project managers. I mean, you can't just pick these guys up from the street, you know, so you have to keep them on your books.
Yeah.
But they're not doing anything at home, so they want to train them. They want to train them on the latest sort of like, you know, project management and design software. And so, you know, they're actually doing a lot of online training. And, you know, and that was in their, you know, in their tweet or in their announcement they did yesterday. So they'll be absolutely fine. I've got no doubt about Alecosoft. They're going to get to the other side, and they're going to be one of the winners on the other side. When that is, I don't know, but I'm assuming 2021 is going to be, we're going to be getting back reasonably to normal. And then the other one, which is again more in the sort of like, you know, the more being impacted more by COVID-19 and the oil and gas, is Northbridge. But their biggest, or what I call the jewel in the crown, which is the biggest division, Crestwick Load Banks. It's still, the reason why it's having problems is even though it's supplying a lot of, you know, essential customers that serve essential services or near essential services, it's difficult to get on site, but that will alleviate. I mean, they're going to be the first to go in these, you know, when they start lifting the lockdowns. So that will be back to normal, and it will be slow. As you rightly point out, it'll be slow. It'll be, you know, Q2 will probably start, end of Q2, then Q3 will be likewise slow, but it should be back by Q4. And then the oil and gas, the Tasman side, which they've got, hasn't actually been affected that much, even though the oil price has gone down, but probably will. But again, I think they're going to get through this year, which is going to be tough. And that's the key. Is the business that you have, is it going to actually survive? And then can it flourish on the other side? And I think both of those ones can. Do you still own EasyJet and Alecosoft?
I still own EasyJet, yes. Alecosoft, no, I got out because I just thought, right, I don't know where this could go. And it's obviously leveraged the housing sector. And I thought, do you know what? And I was trying to start off with almost a clean sheet.
Absolutely.
But
yeah,
I have one slot. Literally, I my portfolio is going to be holding 16 stocks. So I've got two slots in the big cap category that I want to get. I do own EasyJet Greg's AutoTrader at the moment. I'm looking for one in that small cap, you know, growth. And Alikosoff is in my shortlist. And literally, if the price weakens a bit more, because it's at that V bounce, if it weakens more, I'll be really tempted. And that's a leverage to the house building side, isn't it? So
yeah, it is. So, but the point is, I think, is that the people that they sell to actually use the software.
Yeah.
Are the almost the last people they get rid of? They don't furlough these guys. They keep them on their books because they're the guys who actually make them all the money, who add the value. You know, who effectively buy their plots, who then design the plots and then build it towards it. So it's all that digitization, and it's those people. Anyway, you're exactly right. There is an element of GDP on the side of it, but they have actually withdrawn their guidance. But overall, the mood music, my view from the RNS is that they're absolutely fine. They've got cash on the balance sheet. Yes, it's going to be difficult like every other business for 2020, but they're going to come through it and they're going to do really well. So I mean, I'm prepared to hold for that one for a long time. I wouldn't hold EasyJet though, having looked at its numbers this morning. But it's a great brand.
Well, essentially, they said they can, not fly anything ground start till December, pretty much. And so, I can't see them not doing any generating revenue till December, because if they do that, there's so many companies that will go through. And I just think, at the moment, there's already this argument. In fact, in America, there's protests already happening. People gun-wielding people in Michigan saying, we don't want lockdown. Our business is getting broken. And it is that thing against the risk-reward of trashing the economy for when we're sort of over the curve a little bit now. We're heading down, So I just think they'll start taking bookings. You see the guy from Carnival? Yeah. I couldn't believe that. Carnival Cruises. I think he's lying. The CEO is on CNBC, and he reckons they're already taking bookings right now for 2020. He said quite a few in 2021 as well. So I thought, really? Who is booking cruises? And if people are booking cruises, I mean, they're hardcore fans there of cruises, of course. But I mean, if people are booking cruises, I'll have no doubt when they start taking bookings, and I think some of the companies now are taking bookings for June 2. I think already. They don't know whether they'll be up and ready then, but I think they'll definitely have bookings before the end of the year. And and they said worst case scenario, if it just goes to the end of the year, they can hang on till then. So 900 million, I think, the capital expenditure for years, and they've got plenty. And I just think, I can see this starting to ramp back up July, August, September, definitely before the last quarter. So I don't know.
I mean, the two things I would say is there are a lot of businesses that are taking bookings, and they're but under this auspices such that they're actually going to hand the money back. They don't actually believe they're going to start, but it's all like it's an optionality thing. Yeah. Doesn't cost you any money to process a flipping booking, and you've got the cash up front, so it's net neutral. Yeah, so it makes absolute, but particularly if you need cash, you have the cash. So I wouldn't take that much reassurance that they're taking bookings. And the other thing to think about is that if we do go 9 months and their fleet is ground and they get through that £3 billion worth of liquidity, if they do that, what's the shape of the balance sheet like? I mean, they're going to be absolutely pants. So,
but didn't they say this expenditure was about 900 million and they've got 3 billion?
No. Basically, they've split it down. I mean, that's what I'd have a look. I think I might have it here. Hang on, let me just have a quick. Have a look anyway, but when I read it, here it goes. This analysis has shown that we have sufficient cash resources to remain liquid across a number of scenarios. During a 3-month grounding of EasyJet, we would use around £1.2 billion. During 6 months, we would use £2.2 billion in cash, and the 9-month grounding, we would use around £3 billion in cash. So what will the balance sheet like if it goes on? I mean, all I would say is that it's a quality name. It's likely to be there, but you could see a lot. It all depends on how far, how long you think this is going to last for with flying. But I do think flying is going to be the last part of it. If we get a medical solution, then we'll go pretty quick, no doubt about it. But
yeah, I just, I know it's a bit of, I haven't got a lot in there, literally. Let me just check my thing. Out of the big caps, I've literally got just under 1% of my portfolios in there. But, I've got a holiday booked for July. I'm quite confident.
Have you? You're not going, mate.
No, we've cancelled. We've cancelled one already. But I think, I'm almost a leap of faith, I think human ingenuity, well, we'll come up with something before then. There's so many people working on this now, so many top scientists. I think something will happen, something will break. And even like, you know, there was one guy, he was a scientist, a medical scientist on this on CNBC. He honestly believes there's a lot more people immune to it right now than we know, and he was quoting figures from Iceland, and he was he was up to date on it, and he had a lot of knowledge on it, and so
The person I would recommend that investors follow is a guy called Dr. Scott Gottlieb, and he's the ex FDA lead. Sort of like director, and he's on CNBC, he's on NBC. He might be the guy you've actually heard, but he's got the, in my view, he's by far and away got the best handle on what is being actually researched and what's likely to come through, and what the immunity rates are in certain populations. And if you actually listen to him, his view is that America is less than 5% has got, you know, the population's got immunity, even though it's obviously a hotspot in New York. And likewise, in the UK, we had, you know, I think it was Imperial College putting out a report saying the UK had less than 3%. So we're talking certainly less than 10%. Yes, there might be certain industries, there might be certain locations which have more than 10%. We're still small beer. I mean, I think we might well get an antiviral, and Scott Gottlieb believes we might get an antiviral by the autumn, and he's hoping that we will do. But that will be a game changer. But the real, you know, sort of the way to beat this is through the vaccine, which will become next year. And I think the underlying assumption that, in my view, that investors should work to, is such that we're going to have to live with this pathogen until we get a vaccine, which is going to be really 18 months' time, 15 to 18 months' time, And under that scenario where we are living with it, we will start releasing the economy where it's the most important and least risk. So near essential services, construction, house building are definitely going to go. We'll have small restaurants, small bars will open, but they'll have social distancing. You may even get sports events, but you'll only have like 25% of the crowd there because they'll have to sit, you know, have two seats between them. But I'm not sure. I would be very surprised. And you might well have flights. Don't get me wrong. You might well have flights, but they'll have social distancing. Well, they'll have a third of the plane full. And if
Exactly. They'll knock the revenue. I understand. But the thing is, I just think at the moment, we know now how it's spread pretty much, you know, and so they will have to, like I said, instill these social distancing rules, not use the middle seats and all that kind of stuff, even wear masks. And, you know, when it comes down to it, even when we lift these restrictions, people have to be aware. We still have to, there's only two ways of pretty much contracting this. Once you breathe in droplets, people's coughed or whatever, you get too close to people. And secondly, you touch something, it's infected, you put your hands to your mouth, so washing your hands and not touching your face. So I think with this in place, you know, I think they'll have to open the economy to certain extent, like you say, maybe yes, but that's why, you know, that explains why EasyJet has gone from 15 quid to 5 quid, you know, so that's exactly why it's down there. So it's
But when it comes to upgrading, or, you know, sort of your portfolio to big caps, which are obviously on sale, then I would choose those companies that are likely to be have their industries opened up quicker. So house builders is one. The medical side, drugs is obviously great. I mean, if you look at sort of the medical devices, for instance, they're effectively in not lockdown, but all their elective procedures will happen going forward, but they're not happening at the moment, so the shares have come down. I haven't yet gone through all the research of those. So it's choosing the right spots that you can upskill. Now, just coming back to what I originally said, when you look at that sort of investor sentiment swingometer, I'm more toward drifting more towards the positive side, because I actually do think we have, you know, a Jerome Powell put into the market, i.e. such that, yes, there is 20 to 25% downside in this. But at that point, central banks around the world, particularly if it starts hitting the credit markets, are just going to continue printing. They're going to do another round. Come hell whatever, you know, it doesn't really matter, you know, they'll just, even if they're going to get, you know, sort of like, you know, the risk of hyperinflation and debasement of currencies and this, they're just still going to do it. And on that basis, you don't want to be in cash, you know. So I think the strategy that you're deploying, and, you know, I'm moving towards it, is to start looking selectively, upskilling in areas that are not grounded and won't stay. I mean, I'm not going into airlines, full stop, you know, and, you know, leisure and stuff that I have to have a real leap of faith. But where I can see these things opening in a social distancing world, then that's the place to go, because you want to be then in companies that have pricing power, have technology, and will work in a social distancing world. And I don't think airlines will work in that latter requirement, but things like house builders will, medical guys will, and there's lots of other industries where you can upgrade your portfolio with reasonable safety. That, you know, if the central banks do press that sort of like, you know, helicopter money button, then you're not going to lose, you know, your money in nominal terms. In real terms, you're actually going to, you know, you're going to have some sort of protection. So
no, I agree. I mean, you have to look at the timing of reopening. I understand. Do you know what? I think, as I said, one of the first things, people go back to work. I mean, I think Greg's will be safe. It'll be start opening back up, things like that. But I mean, yeah, I'll have to get into a house builder. Paul, I've got to go, but that's good. Yeah, it's definitely worth looking at, isn't it? Look at the timing of these companies and when they'll be opening back up. Certain companies will be opening back up a lot faster than other companies. But yeah, good stuff. Paul, listen.
Great, Justin.
Thanks, fella. We'll speak to you next weekie.
Yep, sounds good.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five. Avacta Group, AVCT, down 0.25% at 67.5. At four, Tiziana Life Sciences, up 16% at 65 pence. Tills is ticker there. At three, Novacyt, down 6.25% to 4.12. At two, Omega Diagnostics Group, ODX ticker, down 6% to 29.5 pence. And at one, it's Advanced Energy Group, non-mover, 0.105. All right, top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At five, Director Changes at Armadale Capital, down 2.4%, 2 pence. At four, I have Jubilee Metals Group, update operations during lockdown in South Africa. At three, Sandfire Resources update. At two, Amiga Diagnostics Holdings in Group. And number one most liked RNS was from Bidstack Group, Independent Research Report. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. By the way, Bidstack at the moment is up 7%, 7.625 pence. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.